From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Texas stays the execution of Larry Robeson, but is set to execute another man today, the 100th execution under Governor George Bush's watch. We'll get reaction from the mother of Larry Robeson. Also, apparel manufacturers agree to settle a lawsuit accusing them of allowing sweatshop conditions in Saipan. We'll talk about the grassroots movement that continues to grow. And as Serbia prepares for a major anti-Milosevic rally, we'll speak with the leading women protester in Yugoslavia. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Disaster relief teams from around the world today joined overwhelmed Turkish rescue crews in the hunt for bodies and survivors of a devastating earthquake that's left nearly 3,500 people confirmed dead and more than 14,000 injured. The outpouring of foreign assistance is certain to accelerate the work among the toppled buildings and homes following one of the most powerful quakes to strike anywhere in the 20th century. Bodies overflowed hospital morgues and were stacked in refrigerated meat trucks. The government has recorded 3,479 deaths, but that number is certain to grow as more bodies are recovered. Russia is blaming its peacekeeping partners for the continuing revenge attacks against Serbs in Kosovo. The foreign ministry says the attacks are the outcome of what it calls the West's policy of pacifying Albanian separatists. The statement's a clear reference to American support for ethnic Albanians and the separatist Kosovo Liberation Army during the 78-day NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. Later in the show, you'll hear from Vesna Pesic, one of the leading anti-war protesters in Yugoslavia. Suharto, the ailing former dictator of Indonesia, will not travel abroad for treatment, according to diplomats, because he fears being held for crimes against humanity after the arrest of his Chilean counterpart, Augusto Pinochet. Suharto suffered a minor stroke last month, was readmitted to the hospital over the last weekend, but rather than traveling to Germany, where he received treatment 3 years ago, the 78-year-old former general has been advised by his legal team that leaving Indonesia would be too risky. A woman who fled Africa 2 years ago to avoid genital mutilation has been awarded political asylum. The Board of Immigration Appeals granted the petition of Adelaide Abankwa on the ground that she had good reason to fear genital cutting if she returned to her native Ghana. Ms. Abankwa, who's 29 years old, is the second woman to win asylum in the United States because of the threat of genital mutilation, which millions of African girls and women undergo each year. Abankwa was arrested for trying to enter the country with false immigration papers when she arrived at Kennedy Airport on March 29, 1997. President Joseph Estrada of the Philippines granted a 45-day reprieve to a man scheduled to die today for raping a daughter, and he said he will suspend all other executions until he's formed an expanded committee to review death sentences. Estrada said the new committee will include retired judges, educators, and religious leaders. It'll replace a current committee composed of cabinet members. Estrada said he's making the move as a birthday gift to his spiritual advisor, the leader of the Roman Catholic El Shaddai organization. The Reverend Jerry Falwell plans to tone down his anti-gay rhetoric in anticipation of a meeting with 200 gay men and lesbians this fall. Falwell's change of heart comes after meeting with the Reverend Mel White, a gay activist. White plans to take a group of gay men and lesbians to an October dinner with Falwell. White says Falwell's a victim of misinformation about gays. Falwell, who is often heckled by gay rights activists, says he welcomes the chance to lower the rhetoric on both sides, but he says he still thinks homosexuality is a sin. The U.S. military is turning to Tinseltown for help to make its war exercises more realistic and improve training for soldiers. The Army is giving the University of Southern California $45 million over the next 5 years to establish a research center to create highly realistic training simulations. The Army wants filmmakers to make simulated characters more realistic and come up with storylines that get soldiers emotionally involved. Officials say film students and video game designers will use the latest advances in virtual reality and artificial intelligence. Democrats and civil rights groups have attacked the states of Florida's decision to settle a lawsuit challenging Florida congressional districts, denouncing a plan to alter several districts as a backroom deal. The deal, approved by lawyers for Governor Jeb Bush, still must be approved by a panel of three federal judges. The plan would change the boundaries of seats now held by two black Democrats, Alcee Hastings and Carrie Meek, and a Latino Republican, Ileana Ross-Leighton, along with five neighboring districts. The plan was devised to settle a lawsuit filed last year by a white candidate, Tom Fouts, who lost a bid for a state Senate seat held by a black incumbent. Under the terms of the settlement, Fouts dropped any challenge over state districts. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And I'm sure that it comes as no surprise to Democracy Now! Listeners, but to a lot of the country it did, that Wen Ho Li, the American scientist, the Chinese-American scientist who has been targeted in the atomic spy case by federal officials, got an unusual defense yesterday from the former head of counterintelligence at Los Alamos, who says that he was singled out because of his ethnicity, because he was one of the only Chinese-American scientists working at Los Alamos, and he has now put it down to racism as part of why he was singled out.
Well, it's a continually interesting story and painful story, and one of the issues not raised very much by the mainstream media, despite all of the news coverage that Wen Ho Li got, was the fact that he was never indicted. And yet seemed to be the cause, and in fact has been the cause, of a whole new agency being set up, which will take a lot of power away from states and make the nuclear weapons industry in this country even more top secret and less accountable than it has been over the last decades.
Yes, and as the former head of counterintelligence, who has since been removed himself, says of 83 American scientists who traveled to China over the period of time being investigated, there were many white Americans who were never even looked at, but Wen Ho Li was instantly singled out by those looking for wrongdoing.
Well, we're going to turn now to a story that we have been covering for the last few days, and is the story of the death penalty in Texas, the capital of capital punishment. Just hours before Texas was to put to death a mentally ill man yesterday, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted him a stay of execution. Lawyers for Larry Robeson, a paranoid schizophrenic man, had argued that he was not mentally competent to be executed, and the courts have asked for an evaluation of his condition. The court, composed of nine Republicans, eight of them former prosecutors, split in a 5-4 decision in favor of staying Robeson's execution. Robeson confessed to killing five people in August of 1982. His lawyers and his family say he was severely mentally ill, and Pope John Paul II and several mental health organizations have appealed for mercy on his behalf. Robeson's family says the state refused to give him proper treatment for his illness, and he was released from several public hospitals just before he went on a killing spree. Mental health advocates have pointed out that while Texas spends an average of $2 million in capital trials, it ranks 49th in the country for mental health spending. Well, yesterday on Democracy Now!, just before going to prison to see her son for what she thought would be the last time, Larry Robeson's mother, Lois Robeson, talked to us about her family's ordeal in dealing with Larry's mental illness, his crimes, and the death sentence. She then went to the prison, said goodbye to him, she thought, for the last time, because in Texas, the family must leave by 12 for a 6 o'clock Texas time execution. And a few hours later, she learned that his execution was stayed. She joins us again today to talk about what happened. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lois Robeson.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what yesterday was like for you?
Well, we said goodbye to Larry for the last time, we thought. I told him about all the things that I remembered about him as a little boy and how much we all loved him, and he told us how much he loved us, and he just sat there and stared into our eyes for minutes. I don't know how he did it, unblinking. He just stared into our eyes and says, "I'm sending you love from my heart," and he was just absolutely silent. And but then we thought that it was the last time we left the prison. We even had some pictures made where we were on the outside of the cage and he was on the inside of the cage, and the photographer made pictures of us with our heads up against the glass for final pictures of him for us to remember him by. And we thought it would be the last visit we would ever have with him. We still had some hope, but because we knew that this was right, that he was mentally ill, and we still had hope. But, you know, from what we had heard, we were prepared for him to die. We left, and we went out to eat with all of our friends and family members. And as we got to the restaurant, we were just starting to walk in the restaurant, and his lawyer, I heard her scream inside, and then she came running out with a cell phone in her hand, and she said, "Oh, he got to stay, he got to stay, he got to stay." And we all started screaming, and said, "He got to stay." And we were hugging and kissing, and everybody was just screaming, "Larry, got to stay, Larry, got to stay." And everybody was crying. It was so incredible. We never gave up hope, but we were not expecting it at that moment, and it was just incredible. All the love that people poured out to us, all the people that we've been talking to all these years, the people from the Journey of Hope were with us, the people from Amnesty International, our friends and family, people from our church, our ministers, most of our family members, everybody who could get there, we were all there. And we were all just hugging each other and kissing each other and saying, "Now we have a chance to go back into court and tell the truth that we never got to tell before." And so that's what we're doing now. We know this is just a stay, and we know that we've got a lot of work to do, but we do have a chance now. We finally have a lawyer, an experienced lawyer, who cares and who knows what we need to do, and who knows how to do it right. And this time it's going to be done right by somebody who's experienced. And if she had been there for the first trial, Larry would be in a mental hospital right now, because she knew what the issues were and she knew how to handle the case. She had experience. And she did this for us pro bono because she cares and because she wants to save Larry. She's been practically living with us for the last few weeks, and it was just incredible that it happened. It was incredible.
Well, Mrs. Robeson, I'm sure you're aware by now that your son's case is representative of so many in America, because I think one of the great scandals of our time is the number of mentally ill people who are being incarcerated and treated as criminals rather than as people who have illnesses that need to be treated. And I know I've reported numerous occasions of people who committed crimes here in New York City who ended up having long histories of mental illness that went untreated because our country, of course, tried to deinstitutionalize and sent so many people out of mental institutions in the last few decades.
Onto
the streets now. Now they're in jail, yes. Right. And how do you cope with this, and do you see yourself as representing so many of these other inmates?
We have always done this for all the mentally ill in prison, all the mentally ill on death row. In fact, let me tell you what happened to us when we were visiting yesterday at death row. Jose Trevino was there because he has an execution date for tonight. And I went by and I talked to him, and my husband talked to his family because they don't even speak English, but my husband is a Spanish professor, and he spoke to them in Spanish because they couldn't understand what I was saying in English. They say no habla inglés. But I talked to Jose, and I said, "Jose, we're doing this for you too, and we're going to fight for your life too, just as hard as we did for Larry and for everybody else on the road that's mentally ill, and we're going to keep fighting until we get proper mental health care for everybody." And I said, "We're going to be with you. Remember this tomorrow. We're fighting for you too. We're fighting for everybody." it's not just Larry, it's for everybody. And he thanked me, and he said that he understood, and I said, remember tomorrow, we'll be there loving you through the whole thing, and we're going to fight to the last minute to save you, too. And I wish that the people that helped save Larry, because so many people call, and I wish that the people that call for Larry to save Larry would you please call and help save Jose Trevino, because otherwise they're going to kill him tonight, and that would be so horrible if they gave Larry a stay and then turn around the next night, and another mentally ill man has to take his place as a 100th execution in Texas. Our family would just be devastated. We're asking everybody to help us to save Jose Trevino and all the other mentally ill on death row.
We're talking to Lois Robeson, who has survived her son's imminent execution or almost execution yesterday. He would have been the 100th person killed under George Bush since he became governor in 1995. It was certainly a surprise turnaround of a court of 9 Republican judges in a 5-4 decision. Now, we're going to talk about Jose Trevino's case in just a minute, the man who is slated to die tonight, 6:00 Texas time. But before we do, we're also joined by the lawyer you were just describing, Lois Robeson, Melody Smith, the attorney for your son, Larry. And Melody, we'd like to ask you, what happens now? We're talking about a 30-day stay, is that right?
Actually, it's an indefinite stay.
An indefinite stay.
And in fact, the Court of Criminal Appeals was very specific that only they will decide the fate of Larry Robeson. What they basically said was this is the evidence that we provided them will and should have been before a hearing in trial court. And so they sent this back to trial court and said, you are ordered to have a hearing on this case, and then only after we review what you do will we decide what to do next. So it is... because the warrant for Larry's execution was for August 17th, because they gave him a stay, that warrant has now been canceled. There is no warrant for his death. And only after a court of criminal appeals reviews whatever happens in this case, and, you know, what we're expecting will happen is that the court will now order, the trial court will now order experts to go in and evaluate Larry. There will be a hearing on this matter. And many of the people who signed affidavits, and these were lawyers and family members and psychologists and psychiatrists, these were people with personal knowledge of this man's mental illness and incompetency.
But Melody Smith, can you describe why, after 16 years of him on death row, this happens in the hours before he is supposed to be executed?
The explanation is really quite simple. Until a warrant is signed, the question of whether he is competent to be executed is really moot. In the state of Texas, in fact, in the United States of America, throughout the world, through treaties, it is clear that it is unlawful to execute incompetent people. It's just unlawful. It may be immoral, but even worse for judges, it's unlawful. Now, when this issue was never raised, the issue of competency, if you can believe it, the issue was never raised prior to trial or during the appellate process. So what happened was once that warrant was signed and we began a clemency campaign, I needed to look at what types of issues had been raised and what types hadn't. It was very easy to observe that competency had never been raised in this man's case. And a mentally ill man's case never, you know, this issue, because it was never raised, I wanted to have experts evaluate, and we did, and what we found was indeed there was evidence that he didn't really understand what was happening. Now that the warrant is in place, we raise this issue in a timely manner. It's what, you know, we call in the law ripe. Only now that a warrant has been signed can we even raise the issue of competency, if you follow me, and only now can we litigate it.
Melody Smith and Lois Robeson, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll be back with you. We're also going to talk about the case of the man who now becomes number 100 for Governor George Bush of Texas if he is executed tonight at 6:00. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we talk about the death penalty in Texas. Texas, the home of the governor who would like to be president, Republican contender, way ahead, Iowa straw poll this weekend, once again confirmed he is number one. He bills himself as the compassionate conservative, and in his state, under his reign since 1995, 99 people have been executed. Today would make 100, and Jose Trevino is the man who's slated to be executed tonight at 6. Yesterday, in the last hours before another execution, Larry Robeson, that execution was stayed by a court of 9 Republican judges.
And Melody Smith, attorney for Larry Robeson, what could the appeals court, what are the options open to it in terms of its decision on Robeson's case?
Well, the appeals court decided on a very split decision, by the way, 5 very courageous Republican judges deciding that it should go back to the trial court and that a hearing should be conducted. When that hearing is conducted, the evidence will be presented. The prosecutor seems to be the only person who's really crying out for the death penalty in this case. And unfortunately, it is his burden to prove that Larry is competent to be executed. It's going to be a very, very high burden. Once the court, the trial court, renders a decision, a conclusion, and we don't know when this will be because we will, you know, require weeks, if not months, to prepare this, then that decision will be reviewed according to this order by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. That decision will be reviewed by the appellate court. The only thing the appellate court can do is review that decision and determine whether or not the trial court conducted a fair hearing. And then after that, of course, if he's deemed incompetent, he cannot be executed in Texas and indeed in this country. If he's deemed competent, then again, the court, depending on what it, you know, we will have an entire process available to us where we would go to federal court and go up to the United States Supreme Court to review all these decisions that are made. We will have to just wait and see. And at that point, you know, if the court indeed decides at some point, if another warrant is signed, then we'll simply have to start the clemency process all over again and again go back for mercy to this compassionate governor here in Texas and to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles.
Melody Smith, I want to thank you for joining us, attorney for Larry Robeson. We're also joined now by Art Brender, who is the attorney for the man who would be number 100 today to die in the given the death penalty under the governor, George Bush. You know, there's an interesting piece in the New York Times, a front page piece called Bush's Law and Order Adds Up to Tough and Popular. And it talks about how Bush ran for governor of Texas in 94 with a series of grainy black and white commercials depicting a man abducting a woman at gunpoint in a parking garage, and a moment later, a police officer draping a blanket over the woman's body. And it says that Bush has presided over the nation's largest prison building program and a record number of executions. At the same time, he signed laws expanding the right of Texans to carry guns and has opposed gun control legislation. According to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, crime has already fallen, had already fallen by 25% under Governor Richards, the previous governor, from 91 to 94 as she began the state's multi-billion-dollar prison building program. But executions are accelerating, and Texas is number one for death penalty in this country, in fact, in the Western Hemisphere. Art Brender, can you talk about, very briefly, Jose Trevino's case, who's slated to die today?
I was appointed 16 years ago on the appeal of the case. I didn't try the case. And it's there are two things about it, that maybe three, that bother me very much and I think in a sense are typical of what happened in death penalty cases. Number one, the people are always indigent. Number two, oftentimes they do not get fair trials because of the inexperience of counsel, or in this case where Trevino had experienced counsel, just outright fraud by the state in not presenting evidence to his lawyers and that was necessary and legal and should have been provided, and I'll address that in a minute. And then, like I said, not providing much in the way of resources are just ignoring basic rights that if, for instance, Trevino had either had a mother as persistent as Ms. Robinson or had financial resources, I don't believe he would be scheduled for execution this evening. The reason I say that is I was, like I said, I was appointed 16 years ago by the State District Court. This case, his case was at one time reversed by the United States Supreme Court, sent back for another hearing. And then when this federal trial came around, I was subpoenaed to testify against the federal judge that was going to hear his case. I was not subpoenaed. I was subpoenaed by the circuit court, who has since taken away this judge's entire docket. It's a rare, unheard of, unknown situation that's occurred in American jurisprudence. A federal judge who has, in essence, because of his abuse of lawyers and litigants and court personnel, has had his entire docket taken away by the circuit courts. That was unheard of. But what the Fifth Circuit did, and now the United States Supreme Court has done, is allowed that to stand and allowed his case to have been determined by that judge while a lawyer who he had no choice in selecting. And by the way, there are 2,000 lawyers in Fort Worth, Texas, any one of whom could have been appointed to do this at the federal level. They refused to let me withdraw, and they allowed the judge to stay in the case and decide the case, even though, as I said, I was involuntarily called as a witness to testify against this judge in this highly unusual proceeding. Those sorts of things are not fair. And so the fairness of the trial proceeding is almost always a question in any of these death penalty appeals if you really look at them. If we're going to take somebody's life, the state's going to do it. I think they have a supreme obligation to make sure they have a fair trial and not have this kind of monkey business go on.
Mr. Bender, in terms of the what you would label, I guess, as prosecutorial misconduct in terms of not providing evidence that to the defense, could you summarize quickly what that misconduct was?
Yes. Let me explain a couple things about how the procedure goes. In Texas, a death penalty jury is selected differently than another jury, and it's an individual voir dire, so that each individual juror is separately questioned. So the questioning process, the jury selection process, what lawyers call the voir dire, can sometimes take several months. Two things happened that I think were misconduct. Number one, the minorities were struck off the jury. And that's what a situation the Supreme Court later reviewed, but then decided it was okay. The second thing is this prosecutorial misconduct with regard to the suppression of evidence. In this case, this young man was accused of, and he has never taken the stand and has denied the participation in this murder. But the evidence that was presented against him was that an elderly lady was her home was broken into and she was murdered and sexually assaulted. This Joe Trevino had, since the age of about 6 or 7, been in foster homes or in state care entirely his entire life until he was 19 years old. During that time, he was very savagely attacked by his own father and beaten. And that's what first got him into state custody. And there's ample evidence that while he was at the Texas Youth Council, while he was in various schools, all of them in state custody now, he was constantly in state custody from the time he was about 6 years old, that showed he has organic brain damage. He has a very severe form of organic brain damage. At his trial, his lawyers attempted to subpoena these records, and their records were under various confidentiality rules and so forth, subject to being subpoenaed, but not subject to being obtained otherwise. The caseworker who is in charge of providing those records refused to provide them. So during this voir dire process, in other words, after the trial in essence had already started, the jury selection had started, the judge, in a very, very unusual proceeding, ordered a deposition. We never do depositions in criminal cases in Texas. It just isn't done. It's done all the time in civil cases, but not in criminal cases. And I only know of two instances where it's happened in 26 years I've been practicing law in this county. And this is Tarrant County is the 13th largest county in the nation. Okay, it's not a little place.
Mr. Brender, we just have a few seconds.
All right. Well, this official did not bring these records to the deposition, did not bring them to court, and lied about the fact that they existed. They were not found until later on. And that evidence would have been very, very crucial at both the guilt or innocent stage because of the nature of his defense, that some other guy was there and presented he presented evidence of that and so forth, that he was sort of the lookout and that sort of thing. And it would also bear on the punishment, whether or not he should be punished, whether he was responsible, et cetera, because he's obviously a brain-damaged individual.
Well, Art Brender, we want to thank you very much for being with us, attorney for Jose Trevino, who is slated to die tonight at 6 o'clock Texas time. And I just want to say in a footnote to this whole story, Larry Robeson, who got a stay of execution yesterday, of the five people he was convicted of killing, one of them is the son of the secretary of Art Brender, the attorney for the man slated to die today. And so I wanted to end with Larry's mother, Lois Robeson, and your comment to the families of the victims of your son, Larry.
Oh, my comment to the families of the victims? Oh, we grieve for them. We want to reach out in love to the victims. We're sorry they had to be put through all this agony. We didn't do this to cause them more pain. It's caused us more pain, too, but we did this so that this doesn't have to happen to other victims' families. No family should wake up to find out that their family has been brutally murdered by a mentally ill person who's extremely psychotic because they are treated and unmedicated. It should never happen.
Well,
it should have never happened.
I thank you very much for being with us, Lois Robeson, a mother of Larry Robeson, who got a stay of execution yesterday. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on with the show, in the next segment, we'll hear from the leading women activist in Serbia in this day before a major anti-Milosevic protest will take place in Belgrade. But before we do that, this news on sweatshops. Four retail companies have become the first to settle claims against them in a class action lawsuit that accuses them of using sweatshop labor in garment factories in the Pacific island of Saipan, which is located in the U.S. Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Islands. Nordstrom, Cutter & Buck, J. Crew, and Gymboree are the first retailers to agree to create a joint independent monitoring system of their contractors, which is designed to ensure compliance with U.S. labor laws and international human rights treaties. A Massachusetts nonprofit firm called Verite, Verification of Trade, will monitor the compliance and will have far-reaching powers to oversee the conduct of contractors working for the four retailers. And we're joined right now by a member of Verite, as well as Medea Benjamin from Global Exchange, based in San Francisco, is one of the groups involved with the whole campaign to expose the companies who have factories on Northern Marianas Island of Saipan. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Medea Benjamin, we only have a few minutes. Can you summarize for us what's happened and how much farther you have to go?
Well, I'm not sure how much your listeners understand about the case, but it's a U.S. territory and been a moral outrage that workers have been brought in from China, Bangladesh, Philippines, to work as virtual slaves in the island of Saipan, with companies denying it all along. And so this is a real breakthrough that these four companies have agreed to a settlement. What's in front of us now is that there are still a dozen companies that haven't agreed, the largest one being The Gap. And so we are now focusing on The Gap to push them to settle as well.
And the and how was the decision made to use a Verite as the organization that would monitor compliance?
Well, there has been a lot of controversy over what is independent monitoring, with companies preferring to use for-profit auditing firms like Ernst & Young and PricewaterhouseCoopers. And, of course, the companies that were settling with us, they wanted to use these very same kinds of firms. And we said, no, we think that monitoring business should be the business of nonprofits. Verite is a nonprofit. And Verite also prides itself on worker interviews, feels that that is the main part of monitoring is to hear what workers have to say. And so we, the plaintiffs in this case, and that's Global Exchange, Sweatshop Watch, Unite, the Garment Workers Union, and the Asian Law Caucus, chose Verite, and we were very lucky to get the companies to agree to them.
And Mil Nipol, could you tell us a little bit about Verite and how it developed and what you expect to do in this case in particular?
Well, first I'd like to say that we're very happy to be involved in this because we think that the plaintiffs have really brought a suit that's very groundbreaking because it's going to allow us to create a permanent presence. Typically, Verite is monitoring worldwide, and we go in and out of countries, but in this instance, we have the opportunity to set up a permanent presence. Verite has been around for 4 years, and we've monitored in over 32 countries, including Saipan. And our process relies heavily on the worker interviews, which are conducted by people of the same gender who speak the local dialect and who are advocates in the human rights and social advocacy areas.
You talk, Medea Benjamin, about the Gap not agreeing. Why? Why not?
Well, I think the Gap is a pretty immoral company that is riding high right now. It's one of the wealthiest U.S. retailers. Donald Fisher, the chairman, is worth $8 billion. They've got profits last year of $843 million. It's got plenty of money that it can put into fighting this suit. And I think it's going to... It's a bad decision on the part of the Gap. I think these four companies that stepped forward to settle really now have taken the moral high ground. But, you know, if the Gap is being intransigent in this, we as a movement have to really step forward and put the pressure on the Gap. And since we don't have much time, Amy, I just wanted to make sure that I was able to give out Global Exchange's number for people to join us in this campaign around the Gap and also the Gap's number.
Go ahead.
So Global Exchange is 1-800-497-1994. We need to have people out front of Gap's stores all over the country. You know, these stores are opening one a day, and we need to get out there and tell them what we think about the Gap using slave labor to make their products. And you can also call the Gap directly at 1-800-333-333.
I want to say we invited the Gap to be a guest on the show. They refused, but they did send a statement that says the settlement, which contains no admission of liability, simply reflects the high costs of litigation, even for an action that we believe lacks merit. We reiterate our strong support of efforts to protect workers' rights and promote safe working environments in garment factories. We believe Gap Inc.'s monitoring program, which we've had in place for years, is at least effective as the one the settlement establishes. Your response?
Well, it isn't. We met with the Gap before the lawsuit, and we said to them, what are you doing to ensure that the women who come to Saipan have not been forced to pay these exorbitant recruitment fees, which is the basis of what we call indentured servitude? If they get to the island already owing $10,000, and imagine a Chinese worker owing $10,000 and have to spend the entire first year working just to pay back that debt, that's slavery. And the Gap said to us, we have no idea and can't be held responsible for what happens to the women before we get to the island. And Verite in this monitoring system will now be interviewing every worker to ask, were they forced to pay a recruitment fee? How much was that recruitment fee? And basically the companies that signed the settlement have agreed that they will use no contractor that uses recruitment fees.
And Mil Nipoli, account director for Amherst-based Verite, how is the agreement going to be? Your monitoring going to be financed, and what kind of reporting are you going to do? Is this going to be periodic, every 6 months, or is it going to be an ongoing reporting system?
Yes, it's going to be actually a quarterly reporting system, which is a very high frequency. Typically, it might be every 6 months in our normal model, but in this instance, part of the settlement, which, by the way, is where the funding is coming from, it's a long-term program. It looks like it's going to be over a period of years, and we have an annual report as well as quarterly reports.
And the phone number of Verite?
Yes, Verite's phone number is 413-253-9227. And we also have a website, which is www.verite.org.
Oh, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange, based in San Francisco, as well as the representative of Verite, Mil Nipold, the account director. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. In the months since NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia ended, thousands of people across the country have taken to the streets demanding that Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic step down from power. Tomorrow night, those demonstrations will for the first time hit the capital city, Belgrade. In the last few weeks, several prominent government officials have accused the main organizers of these protests, the Alliance for Change, of being a terrorist organization backed by the United States. In particular, they've attacked the most prominent female activist in the country. Vesna Pesic is the former president of the Civic Alliance of Serbia, an anti-war group. They're calling her a terrorist. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill spoke with Pesic about these accusations and about Thursday night's demonstration.
I think it's going to be something that we can see how many people would like to come to Belgrade, how many people from Belgrade would like to go out for rallies, and how many of them would support the ideas, you know, of the opposition. Of course, you know, people are now these days frightened that, including this attack against me, I understand that people would like, the regime would like to frighten people not to come. So it's more a test, you know, because we have already months going on with rallies, and we also, in the Alliance of Changes, we think to continue with rallies. So this is just one in the series of rallies, and I think that we need to increase pressure during these 2 or 3 months.
Now, over the last few days, several top government officials have accused the Alliance for Change of being a terrorist organization. Some ministers have even said there is no difference between the Alliance and the Kosovo Liberation Army. In fact, the Prime Minister of Serbia, Mirko Marjanovic, singled you out in particular as being a terrorist for a statement that you made at a recent rally that, if need be, the Romanian solution could be used in Yugoslavia, a reference to the killing of the Romanian ruler Nicola Ceausescu and his wife in 1989. Talk about these accusations.
Well, that's exactly what, yes, I said that it is possible that if you have a society where the normal channels of communication and institutions are not working, and if people are dissatisfied, and if people cannot express their will and their worries and their dissatisfaction, that it might happen something similar like in Romania. But what I had in mind people on the streets, because this is the images that I have in my head thinking about Romania about 10 years ago. And where is the misunderstanding with Mr. Marjanovic, the Prime Minister of Serbia, is that he has in his head and other people around him the scene of Ceausescu and his wife, you know, who were actually killed or accused on a military trial against them. But I didn't have that in mind. I had in mind unsatisfactory people, the images that we saw on television. It didn't have these two leaders of Romania at all in mind. And I think it's a kind of misunderstanding. While I had people in mind, you know, they had this violent act against Nicolae and Elena Ceausescu. I, as a pacifist, and was very much very well known throughout the United States and other countries. I was nominee for Nobel Prize in 1997, and I was awarded several times in the United States also for my peace activities. I am against any kind of violence, and I don't like, you know, that here in Serbia or in Montenegro we go and resolve the problems with violent means. I think it would be a great achievement that we have some resignations, that we have a free and fair elections, and that we build really democratic institutions. So I think that it might happen in any society if the channels, you know, of expressing the will of people are not working. And I had the people in mind and not any kind of violence against someone. And even that, you know, chaotic reactions, like I do in Albania, you know, about 2 years ago, that is always making wrong effects on society and not good effects. But I said, if nothing that we can expect in a year or so, outbursts of people, that's why we need urgent changes. That was my idea. I didn't, of course, try to promote any kind of violence.
Do you think that there was that there are going to be attempts, and that perhaps these statements are part of that, by the government to itself incite violence at these demonstrations?
You never know whether when they speak, you know, that somebody like me or Alliance for Change, that we plan any kind of liquidations or physical acts or something like that, or killing people. I don't know whether they are speaking about us or about themselves, and it becomes dangerous because then you see what the kind of fantasies they have. Since we are all civic parties, I mean, like, for example, when I want to compare here parties, we have some parties which are really armed, like Session Party. The whole party is actually armed, and these parties were around Civic Alliance for Changes. These are parties without any arms. So when they speak, you know, that Alliance for Changes actually went out with the program through my words that we plan killings, murders, physical liquidations, that I don't know whether they speak with the underconsciousness or subconsciousness, whether they have their fantasies. That's why it's frightening for all of us, whether they plan some kind of violence, because they have means for violence. We don't have any means. Even if somebody from opposition would like to be violent, we don't have any means. We are not armed. We are just normal people who would use just their ideas and speeches and nothing, you know, which might be violent.
What exactly are you calling on the current regime? What are you demanding of the current regime right now?
Well, this is obvious, having this campaign, which is lasting more than a month, that we would like to see that President Milosevic is an obstacle for Serbia and Montenegro, especially after being accused by Hatfield, you know, and that nobody wants to communicate with him. He is particularly, as a person now, an obstacle. So it's not so much talking about the regime, about the system. I think that we should have elections, so people would like to have socially owned property, and they don't like private property, so we have programs, you know, for changes, for elections. But this is now a more personal thing, because we have people who are accused, and that nobody wants to communicate with them, and all kind of help for this country, which is left in ruins, that we it's conditioned by his resignation, and that's the whole story now about that we are going with the campaign that he releases the society from his position. Especially, you know, we have a threat of Montenegro that they want to go to independence because of non-future with Milosevic if he stays in power. So this is around Milosevic. This is the story.
Do you have any sense that NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia, whether directly or indirectly, attacked the pro-democracy movement in this country or damaged the pro-democracy movement?
Well, I don't think so. But the problem was that now when this NATO campaign is finished, you know, so almost 2 months now, that we have to ask, what was the intervention all about? The situation in Kosovo. It's not much better, you know, when the Serbian police was there. There was a victim was Albanians, now the victims are Serbs. And that's why I think Americans never understood that there is no really good and bad guys in the Balkans. You know, it depends who is stronger, who is having more arms, you know. And now, you know, you have Albanian, that Liberation Army, and they took a Liberation Army as their defense. And that was very similar with Iran and Iraq, you know, who is friend, who is enemy. And especially now when you have a more described conflict, you know. I think, you know, that it's unfair that we have the situation in Kosovo like we're having now, and that Serbia is left in ruins, and people are not having any future, and most of, you know, of our plants, electric plants, are destroyed by NATO, and now they're threatening us, we're not having electricity, but not because of Milosevic, but because of you. And that's why, you know, we need to be treated for humanitarian help, like electricity, like water, as were Albanians treated, like humanitarian catastrophe. If we need, we are going to be in a situation to be in a catastrophic humanitarian, and then we want to be treated as other tribes here in Balkans, like other nations. And not to say, well, we don't care what will happen with Serbs, because we more and more feel that there is some kind of a racism against Serbs, you know. So when the humanitarian questions are on the table, we expect, you know, to be treated in the same way, and not to say, well, we don't care about them, They could say also for Albania that they couldn't say it, but they said they care. So I think, you know, that this must be clear that some kind of reconstruction of electricity and this is another thing, you know, for the new investment, you know, this is another problem. But enjoy it will be freezing during the winter. And, for example, I have mother, which is 19, I don't know what to do with her. I'll send her to Clinton, you know, my mother, if she's going to be freezing during the winter, during the next winter. So I think, you know, that we should think deeply about the humanitarian problems of people. And that's why I would suggest that we're more serious about that. And that's certainly, you know, not our mistake. And finally, you know, the result of NATO intervention, that we have the ruins here, that we have unemployed people, that we have a social catastrophe here, and we have also Milosevic. So what does that cause? And a terrible situation in Kosovo. So the results are not really flattering.
How far has the opposition movement in this country come since the protests, the massive protests in 1996 and 1997?
The opposition? Well,
the movement for change in this country, how far has it come since that time?
Well, I think that we have to be clear that we have to have a unification of opposition, considering certain issues, like, for example, now the issue of Milosevic and his position, which is non-functional for any kind of future of this country. But I would like to point out that this kind of a pressure for unification, I think that it's too late, that for the opposition, it's enough, you know, that we don't have Milosevic, that we have free and fair elections. And then if we have 1,000 parties, let them be on the elections and who is getting what, this is going to be the situation. But let's have just free and fair election, not to force parties to unite in advance before the election, because then you put them in a situation to quarrel. If you have to divide positions in the government or position of the parliament, and you put, you know, because by definition the parties are something which is partial. And if you put them in a position to fight for the positions in before the election, then of course, you know, this is a situation for the conflict. So I think, you know, that patronizing the opposition now, like we would suggest, for example, all the parties in charge, why don't you unite in one party, actually function as one party? It is not possible anymore. We have these parties for 10 years, but we have to have joint campaigns, like, for example, now against Milosevic. This is important, that, and I'll finish with it. We don't need, you know, only for the opposition to worry whether we have Milosevic as the president of Yugoslavia or not. I think it's also the problem for the socialists. I think it's a problem for any citizen. I think it's a problem also for the Blažković party, for all people who are living here. What kind of future will have with Milosevic as a president? I don't think it's a matter of opposition only, just of all citizens. So we can have a very broad campaign on that issue, but when we have a program, when we have elections, let's party to compete.
Now, several of the opposition figures in this country, so-called opposition figures, have said that they believe that Milosevic will be forced out of power by October or September. But Slobodan Milosevic has showed time and time again his ability to make a comeback, so to speak. When it seems like he's on the ropes, he comes back again. What sort of a timeline do you give for Milosevic leaving power or being forced from power?
It's very difficult to say. Of course, you know, we're all like, you know, that we get out of this tension and that we have a much normal life, and the normal life certainly will not come if Milosevic is staying longer. And there is always all these clouds and all these thoughts, you know, about the possibility of war with Montenegro, the civil war here, and all these clouds, you know, and worries that we have is because of Milosevic. And of course, you know, they would like him to go as soon as possible. But I don't know when this is going to happen. I think that Milosevic really does not have any political future anymore. But when and how he will go is still unknown. My idea is that from our forces in opposition and through this enormous call for change, that we have to do as much pressure as possible. But I also think that some door must be opened from the people who are around Milosevic. From one side only, it's going to be very, very difficult. I don't believe it. That's why I was accused of that. But I really don't believe in social revolution. Even when we speak about Romania, these people on the street did not replace Ceausescu. The army could replace Ceausescu. So if we're on the seat, but somebody from around the Longevich, whether those business elite, those military, or somebody should say, well, this is a door that you have to go. And without that, without the joint efforts from both sides, I don't think the change will happen.
Vesna Pesic is the former president of the Civic Alliance of Serbia. The Slobodan Milosevic regime is calling her a terrorist. Tomorrow night, a major demonstration scheduled for Belgrade. Pesic was interviewed by Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Bernard White is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!